I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. An important article in the Wall Street Journal, which has been unreported, caught our attention, or underreported, I guess is the best word there. It appeared February 4, and it was headlined, Assault on California Power Station Raises Alarm on Potential for Terrorism. In April, a sniper attack knocked out a substation, and it raises concerns for the country's power grid. This took place in San Jose, California. The attack just before 1 a.m. on April 16 of last year. Someone slipped into an underground vault not far from a busy freeway and cut telephone cables. And within half an hour, snipers opened fire on a nearby electrical substation. They shot for 19 minutes. They knocked out 17 giant transformers that funnel power to the Silicon Valley. And a moment before the police arrived, the shooters disappeared. Nobody has been arrested or charged in the attack, and our guest says the attack was the most significant incident of domestic terrorism involving the grid that has ever occurred in the United States, and he was chair of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission at that time. John Wellinghoff is our guest this hour of the program. He is immediate past chair of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. He's an internationally recognized energy law attorney and clean tech energy expert. He has nearly 38 years of experience in federal and state energy policy. He was first nominated to be the FERC commissioner in 2006 by President George Bush, reappointed to the commission in 2008, and in March of 2009, he was named chair by President Barack Obama. We'll be welcoming phone calls as we talk about this very compelling story. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter. If you'd like to join us that way, that is @KDunnShow. John Wellinghoff, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
You're welcome, Kathleen. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Tell me why you said that this is the most significant incident of domestic terrorism involving the grid that has ever occurred in the U.S. Why do you call it an act of terrorism?
Well, ultimately, whatever you call it, it certainly is an incident that you can look at the facts that lead you to conclude that this was not done as a random act of vandalism. It was not done by people who had little or no training. It was not done by individuals who were just doing this on a whim. It was an act that was extremely well planned, and then it was executed in an extremely professional and competent manner, ultimately. So if you look at the facts from the point of cutting the fiber optic cables initially to reduce the 911 traffic, to then moving over to setting up firing positions outside of this high-voltage transmission substation, to then using a sophisticated weaponry to target specific targets rather than randomly shooting in the area, but in fact shooting at specific points of the transformers that were damaged, it all comes together as someone who was very well trained and very dedicated in doing damage to this facility.
And you at the time were the head of this regulatory agency. I understand that you gathered people from Homeland Security and people who had trained Navy SEALs to go out to California and try and find out what happened?
It wasn't actually Homeland Security. It was our own Office of Energy Infrastructure Security at FERC that I actually had initiated several months prior to this incident. And then it was two individuals from the Department of Defense who, in fact, do engage in setting up training missions and missions for special forces for the Department of Defense.
Mm-hmm. And what did you find?
Well, those individuals, the two individuals who went with us, walked the facility, walked externally out into the area where the shooters had positioned themselves, walked over to the cable vaults where these fiber optic cables had been cut, surveyed the entire area, And we came back in the conference room and sat down with the FBI and the PG&E security people, and it was the conclusion of these DOD professionals that this had been a targeting package, was their terminology. Someone had put together a very comprehensive and coordinated plan, and they also indicated that those people who then had executed the plan had a very high level of sophistication and training to be able to stand as far as they did out in the field, away from these transformer facilities with these semi-automatic weapons and hit targets time after time at night under muzzle flash and other incidents of difficulty at the time being at night as well, that this had to be somebody who knew exactly what they were doing.
Were there surveillance cameras on these people, or were they outside the range of surveillance?
Well, there were cameras. They were outside the range of recognizing any features or anything that could identify these individuals. You can see on the cameras freeze frames that were provided, and the video actually has been made available by the Santa Clara Sheriff's Office, it's my understanding. But freeze frames of that video do show clearly, number one, muzzle flashes from the weapons, bullets hitting the fence as they're going through the fence and then hitting their targets, which are the cooling fins of these transformers. And the video also does show clearly flashlight signaling, apparently, to the shooters to commence firing, and then at the end of the 19 minutes to stop firing. And they actually stopped firing 70 seconds before the police arrived and apparently exited the area before law enforcement were on the scene.
Can you, because of your knowledge in this area, speculate about the motives of these people?
No, I can't speculate on their motives. I can only look at the facts as they existed, as they do exist, and from those facts at least conclude that there is one group of individuals who have the capability to carry out this sophisticated level of an attack, a physical attack against this type of grid infrastructure, and that then leads me to the next conclusion that we need to do whatever we can to protect this infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. And have there been attempts and serious attempts to try to locate these individuals who did this?
Well, I'm sure the FBI is doing everything they can. The investigation is in the hands of the FBI at this point in time, and I'm sure they're working to do whatever they can to locate the individuals, although it's my understanding that there really is no evidence in the case other than approximately 120 brass shell casings that were picked up at the site. And it's also my understanding that there's neither fingerprints nor DNA on those shell casings.
Hmm. So tell me about the potential threat to the electrical grid in this country. Is it vulnerable to sabotage?
Well, it apparently is from this incident. And if you then extend it to these high-voltage transmission substations, which there are a limited number of them in the country, there's 100-plus, some of them scattered through three interconnects, Eastern, Western, and Texas Interconnect. And those substations are critical to holding up the entire interconnect. So if you were to have a coordinated attack on a number of them in any one of those interconnects, you could produce the type of blackout that you saw in the 2003 Northeast blackout that was produced by simply a tree touch, a single tree touching a line and resulting in a cascading blackout that caused 50 million people to be without power for a considerable period of time for three or so days. So that type of a cascading event is still possible, and it's unfortunately something that can be perpetrated by someone who is intending to do us harm.
Mm-hmm. The Wall Street Journal article talked about 8 terrorist organizations who have been linked to at least, and this is a huge number, 2,500 attacks on transmission lines or towers, and at least 500 on substations from 1996 to 2006. That's a huge number of attacks.
Well, there have been multiple incidences of all kinds of random vandalism and other things that may have happened. Those reports go into DOE. They're required to go into DOE. There aren't that many purposeful attacks per se. Number one, number two. I'm not familiar with the groups that may or may not have been linked to any of those past incidents. But I do know that this incident is unlike any one of those past incidents in its level of coordination, sophistication, planning, and execution.
Why is it, Mr. Willinghoff, we haven't heard very much about this? You would think it would have been all over the news.
Well, I can't speak for the news media either, in the sense that certainly we, or I at FERC, when I was at FERC, were doing everything we could to publicize the information to the people that we believe to be critical to know the information, and that are the owners and operators of these critical pieces of infrastructure. And we did provide them with briefings. I also provided briefings to the FBI, to the DHS, to DOE, and to other the National Security Agency and other agencies in the federal government, as well as state commissioners, to let them know and make them aware of the seriousness of this event, and then to do whatever I could to provide them with information as to how to mitigate such an event from occurring at their facilities.
Mm-hmm. Well, you would have thought that all of that would have been done after 9/11. It wasn't?
Well, I don't know what was done specifically after 9/11 with respect to the grid, per se, but I don't think that anyone had the thought that someone could perpetrate this in such an effective manner. There certainly were a number of reports that were written even far before 9/11. There was a report back in 1981. There was one in 2004, one in 2012. Federal government reports, each one of those reports talked about physical security of the grid and the most critical point of that security being these high-voltage substations with these high-voltage transformers, and how these transformers are very vulnerable. So this was well known in the industry. It was well known in the government for many, many years, but yet no one had acted on actually improving the physical security of these facilities, and no one had it raised to a priority of urgency until this event made it real.
Mm-hmm. And were there blackouts as a result of this?
No, there weren't. However, this was at a very low load time in April. It was also at night, a low load time. Also, PG&E, as soon as after the event occurred, cautioned people to reduce their power usage because they were having to reroute power and do things to ensure that power did not go out as a result of the outage of these 17 transformers.
Mm-hmm. Well, PG&E must be pretty upset about this, aren't they?
Well, I'm sure they are upset, and I know that they're taking multiple measures to fortify these substations.
What makes you say that you have grown increasingly concerned that an even larger attack could be in the works?
Well, I'm concerned because ultimately we know that there's one group out there who knows how to do it. And so and what concerns me is I don't know who they are. I don't know why they did this. I don't know what they're planning. And so if you know all of those things, and you know that these people are capable and competent to do this, and you also know the other side of it, which is that a limited number of these substations in a coordinated attack could be brought down, or if they were brought down, would in fact cause a cascading outage of an entire interconnect, and you put those two facts together, then you conclude we need to do something very quickly.
What do we need to do?
Well, we need to start doing some very simple things to protect these substations, one of which would be every one of these substations that I know of, probably over 90% of them, are protected with a transparent chain link fence that you can see through, 1,200 yards out with a scope and a rifle. So if we can make these fence is opaque, so you couldn't see the targets inside of the substation. That would be extremely helpful. Certainly, you know, beefing up the lighting and the camera security, and even potentially putting armed guards at the facilities. These facilities are not manned 24/7. Most all of them, I'd say none of them, have people around the clock at them. So there's a number of things you can do. In fact, there was a fairly comprehensive checklist that when I was at FERC, our Office of Energy Infrastructure developed in consultation with a number of other agencies, and we gave that list to the utility executives who own these substations and asked them to consider implementing the items on the list, going from the very lower cost and quick items that could be done initially to the more intermediate and then long-term items, and consider doing them to protect these facilities.
You must have more than a few sleepless nights, John, knowing what happened here and knowing that these people are still at large and we don't exactly know what plans they may have in the works at the moment.
Well, it is extremely disconcerting to me, and sometimes I wonder when I get up in the morning, when I flick the switch, whether the lights are actually going to come on.
And I understand that you have been checking out security at some other sites in your spare time, whatever you might have in terms of spare time.
When I do go into different communities around the country, if I have the time, I try to go to a substation, take a look at it, see what security is there, whether there's anybody there, you know, manning the facility, whether there are any guards, whether in fact there's something beyond a transparent chain link fence, and look and see what has been done. And I have been doing that since April 16th, and haven't seen a considerable level of improvement in most of the facilities I've looked at around the country.
Which means that perhaps they're not being alerted to the fact that there is a danger here.
Well, I hope they have been alerted, but it may just simply be a function of how long it takes them to ultimately make a plan, procure the materials necessary to implement the plan, and actually implement it.
We're going to welcome phone calls for our guest. He is the former chair, immediate past chair of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, John Wellinghoff. He's worked in federal and state energy policy and regulation and project development for a number of years. Also has a particular expertise in emerging clean tech energy system development. A story in the Wall Street Journal, we'll post it on our Facebook page because it's really been a story that hasn't captured everybody's attention. It has not been widely reported. It was in the February 4 Wall Street Journal and talks about the attack in San Jose, California, April 16 of last year. Someone slipping into an underground vault not far from a freeway cut the telephone cables, then opened fire on a nearby electrical substation, shooting for 19 minutes, surgically knocking out 17 giant transformers that funnel power to Silicon Valley. They escaped just a minute before the police arrived, so nobody's been charged on this attack at the PG&E Corporation's Metcalf Transmission Substation. It's an incident very few Americans are aware of, but perhaps we should know more about it, and other substations should know about it to make their security a little tighter than it is at the moment. Here's our number. If you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter @KDunnShow, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we're welcoming phone calls right now for our guest this hour, John Wellinghoff, an American attorney, chair of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission for a number of years. And we're talking about this sniper attack on an electrical substation in California that he says was a terrorist attack. And he worries about how sophisticated it was and what plans whoever did this may be working on right now. Let's go to phone calls. Doug in Menasha is our first caller for you. Hi, Doug.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I was just wondering, you know, you mentioned about having open fences that can be easily seen and fired through, but the thing is, now at the consumer level, we can, there's low-cost drones, you know, basically the modern version of, you know, remote-controlled airplanes and whatnot, helicopters, camera mounts on them. And considering the size and the fragility of these transformers, you don't really need to be that accurate with your shooting, and I'm wondering if simply opacifying the fences is enough, if maybe not having to just go straight to putting up berms within the fences that not only can't be seen through, but can also stop at least direct fire attacks.
Well, certainly there's multiple levels of protection that you can take. And the first thing, again, is I think, to not be able to see the transformers. The second, certainly, is to put up some type of a protective barrier in front of them, whether a jersey barrier or a berm or sandbags, or, I mean, there's multiple things that you can do. I mean, we've got to, you know, prioritize the facilities, number one, and then you've got to prioritize the level of protection and the cost of that level of protection. That's what I believe the utilities are undertaking right now.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much for the call. Peter is next in Appleton. Hi, Peter.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I was just basically thinking along the same lines. However, since these facilities are not owned, I believe, by the government, U.S. government, but they contract through them, I would think that there would be an easy way to have them hardened or armored by requiring them, you know, through, I don't know, some kind of law or whatever in their contract to harden them, I guess you call it, you know, like protect them through whatever minimal means possible, whether it be Kevlar or armored steel or, you know, something cheap, and there's just a lot of things. It boggles me that something so great with, you know, the potential to darken 50 million people's electricity, why we aren't spending as much, you know, to protect them as we are in any other threat, whether it be 50 million on a jet or anything. It just seems ludicrous that there's such a critical point that's so unprotected, you know, mm-hmm. regardless of the cost it would take to protect them. That's all.
Okay, thank you, Peter. Mr. Wallinghoff.
Peter, you make a good point. I mean, if there was a federal agency that could order this be done, they should, but there isn't, unfortunately, at least directly. My former agency had some level of responsibility of reliability to develop and to promulgate rules. Actually, they were developed by another entity and then came to us, and then we put them into rules to do things like ensure that switches and breakers were properly constructed and you had the right levels of resources for reliability. But those rules to do this kind of a effort would take a long, long time to do and may not ever get done exactly the way that they would need to be done. These facilities aren't contracted to the federal government. They're private facilities, and they're in private hands. So it is difficult to figure out how to encourage these people to move forward. I know the industry is moving forward voluntarily on their own, but I'm not certain that that is quick enough. In fact, we may need to put some legislation in place to give some federal agency, whether it be FERC or Homeland Security or some other agency, the authority to actually order entities who have these critical facilities to put in place these types of protections. But then the next step, of course, would be, in addition to ordering them to do that, we'd also have to set up a mechanism to pay for it, and that would be, you know, through some tax mechanism, because ultimately you're protecting facilities that are protecting the whole country, not just the little region where that particular facility is. So ultimately, you know, all the taxpayers should be the ones who should foot the bill for the cost of this. And that's why we want to prioritize which ones are critical, make sure that it's, you know, not thousands, but 100 or less that we protect, and that we protect them with the most cost-effective means.
Mm. I believe that your organization did do a study that found that a surprisingly small number of U.S. substations, if they were knocked out, that they could destabilize the system enough to cause a blackout that would encompass most of the country. So do we know where those substations are? Do we know what needs to be protected right now?
Yes. Congress could enact the law, and they could go to FERC,
or any other agency could run the models, which FERC did run, and pinpoint where the critical substations are. So, yes, we do know where they are.
Let's go to Michael in Milwaukee next. Hi, Michael.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm hearing another solution to a problem which maybe exists, maybe it doesn't exist, maybe it happened once. I mean, it did happen once, but maybe it'll never happen again. We're always chasing our tail in the security thing, just like we did in the schools. You know, something happens in the school and we're going to lock everything down in every school in the country. The way I see it, the whole grid is vulnerable. I would imagine that if they wanted to, while all these substations are guarded, maybe you could have crews that could blow up maybe 3, 4, 5 towers throughout the country and maybe do a lot of damage, too. It's pretty hard to secure the whole grid. It's pretty hard to secure everybody like we want to do in this whole country. And I think sometimes we got to curtail the spending. I mean, we're just falling into the terrorist hands every time we're spending millions and millions of dollars every time something happens, which might not happen again, just like on our airplanes, what we did to the air travel in this country, based on things that happened in the past that might never happen again. Maybe terrorists, if they are out there, are focusing on different targets. I mean, they're smart enough to realize as soon as they do something, we're pounding resources in that we really can't afford. Well, let's look for a different target. You know what I mean? I'm a Vietnam combat veteran, and I'll tell you what, whenever we thought we had the enemy nailed down as to what they were going to do next, they always came up with a different plan. So I don't think the terrorists are any dumber than what the Viet Cong were.
Doesn't it worry you, though, Michael, that they never found any of these people, and who knows what they're planning next? They're just out there somewhere.
It doesn't bother me because we don't know everything, and we can't be expected. And we have turned ourselves into a country of just total fear. We are always afraid of everything, afraid of terrorists, afraid of this. And I think a lot of it comes out of the overhype of the media. I'm basically sick of it. You know, we got everybody running around. The sky is falling throughout the world, throughout the history of the world. People were always at risk from something. If it wasn't dinosaurs, it was invading armies, it was plagues.
Okay, that's your point. John Wellinghoff.
Yeah, Michael, I understand and appreciate the moving target theory, and I'll tell you, I'm not a sky is falling kind of guy, but I'll tell you why this is important. You could take down, you know, selected high-voltage towers in each interconnect, but we could get them back up in a matter of days. If you take out transformers, high-voltage transformers, you knock them out so that they are not repairable, which is fairly easy to do with a bullet through a 5/8-inch steel case, and that's all the cases are, soft steel. Those transformers can't be replaced for 6 months, 12 months, 18 months. There's only 3 transformer manufacturing facilities in the United States. I went to the newest one in Memphis, Tennessee, several days after this incident, and I asked the plant manager, you get an emergency order in here for a new transformer. How soon before you get it out the door? He told me it's 6 months.
Ooh. So if strategic substations were hit and the power grid went down, the worst scenario, it'd be a long time before it went back up, huh?
That's correct. It's not that way with towers. It's not that way with other pieces of equipment. In fact, this particular facility, they didn't hit the transformers per se. They, in fact, didn't aim for the transformers. They aimed for something else, the cooling fins that were outside the transformers. They were easier to hit for them because they could use slower velocity bullets, and they also didn't cause any fire or explosion, so there was no immediate attention drawn to them so they could get away. But they knew exactly what to hit. But those cooling fins were replaced in a matter of weeks. But a transformer itself, the main case of the corn coil transformer, those things take months and months to make and replace.
Have you testified before Congress on this?
Not on this specific issue, but I have testified before Congress from 2006 on that I believed it was necessary to change the law to give some agency the authority over what are called known threats and vulnerabilities of the grid. And this is a known threat or vulnerability, like the cyber security issues, like Stuxnet and other viruses, et cetera. If we know that there's something that's out there that can cause a threat, that is a threat to a facility of the grid like this, then we need to have some agency to have the authority to be able to put a plan together to mitigate that threat and to then implement that plan by ordering people to do something. There's no such authority yet, but in fact, there were pieces of legislation that suggested that such authority be put in place. That legislation, however, has never been passed.
I guess I'm having a hard time understanding why it wouldn't be.
Well, I mean, you know, to take the other side, you know, industry groups would rather self-police and self-regulate, not be under additional regulation, not be under additional costs and, you know, taxpayers' dollars. And there's a side to that, and I can understand that to some degree. But with respect to this particular threat, I think it rises to the level of significance that we do need to do something, and we need to do something collectively. We need to do something at the federal level. We need to do something that can, in fact, ensure that the mitigation measures to reduce the threat are put in place.
Let's go to Forrest in Rolling Ground. Hi, Forrest.
Hey there.
Hi.
I would like to talk about how to really make our grid safe would be, in my mind, to decentralize the power system. Because if there's just a couple of places that anyone can take out, no matter how much security we have, no matter how big the guns are, no matter how much steel we put around them, somebody's going to be able to come in and do something. And we're never going to be able to protect ourselves from any number of people who may want to do the power grid harm. So any way to make the grid truly safe would have to involve seriously decentralizing the power system. If every house has a solar panel on its roof, good luck trying to take out the power grid.
John.
Well, Forrest is ultimately right. But unfortunately, we have to deal with the system that we have, not the system that we want to have. And we are moving to the system that Forrest is talking about. We're putting on new solar systems on people's houses one every 4 minutes. But it's going to take putting on one every 4 minutes 10 to 20 years till we get to the place that Forrest is talking about where we have a decentralized grid. I think we will get there. I think it will be decentralized, and as such, it'll be much more safe, much more reliable, much more dependable. But in the interim, we need to protect what we have now to ensure that we don't have that blackout in, you know, next year, two, three, four, five, going forward.
Is part of the problem the chief executive of the North America Electric Reliability Corporation was quoted in the article in the Wall Street Journal saying that he thinks the grid is more resilient. I quote him, "I don't want to downplay the scenario that you describe, actually, John, but even if several substations went down, the vast majority of people would have their power back in a few hours." Is he indicative of the sentiment of other people who run these grids?
Well, I don't want to criticize that individual, but I want to say this. My facts are based upon computer modeling that my electrical engineers, when I was at FERC, did. I believe they're competent. I believe they're capable. That model has been shown to that individual who's the head of the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, and it's never been challenged, to my understanding. So I believe that the data that I have is correct, that there are a very few number of critical nodes within each interconnect, and if, in fact, you knocked out those nodes, the entire grid would not stand up.
Forrest, thanks for your call. Eric in Portage, hi.
Hi, something he just said was his facts were based on computer modeling. That wouldn't actually be facts. That would just be computer modeling. So I challenge that. First person to challenge that, apparently. But my main comment I wanted to say is if it takes 12 to 18 months to replace those transformers, why didn't San Jose have to wait 12 to 18 months? And what would be wrong with ordering, if it just takes a few of these places to get hit, to have the power grid go down, what's wrong with pre-ordering a couple of these transformers? And wouldn't that save, like, billions of dollars in security costs?
Let me address those points one by one. Number one, the computer models that I'm referring to are the most sophisticated that we have, and we use those models every day to not only predict but backcast what, in fact, did happen. So outages that we've seen happen, we use these computer models, and they predict those outages that actually physically happen. So there's a correlation between the physical events that we have seen happen of certain outages like the 2003 blackout and others that these models, in fact, have predicted as well. So I think they're very sound. Secondly, as I explained, they didn't shoot at the transformer cases in San Jose. They shot at the cooling fins, which are an appurtenance to the transformer. They're attached. They're fairly easy to get. They got them in a matter of weeks. If you shoot through the case of a transformer, you don't get the transformer in a matter of weeks unless you have a spare. Yes, they do have spares, but most of the spares right now are located on the same substation plots that the rest of the transformers are located at. So they're really not very secure, number one. But even with that, you know, it really would take, you know, hundreds of transformers in spares, and they would have to be set up in ways that they would work in each one of these substations. And each one of these substations is fairly unique, so it's not necessarily the case that you can have one transformer that would work in North Carolina, that would work in Montana, that would work in Florida, that would work in Southern California. They're not necessarily interchangeable like that because of their component parts and their configuration and the amperages and various other things related to the transformers themselves. So, you know, it'd be very difficult to have, you know, a spare transformer program, although the utility industry does have such a program. But look at the facts here. We had 17 transformers that were taken out in 19 minutes. How long would it take to take out,
wow,
you know, 100 transformers?
Yeah. Thanks for the call. We'll take more in just one moment. We're talking about a story, an important story that took place on April 16 in San Jose, California. And it was an assault on a California power station. It raises concerns about potential for future terrorism. Our guest says that this is the most significant incident of domestic terrorism involving the grid that has ever occurred in the United States. And when he said that, he was chair of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. He was appointed by President George Bush, and he became chair under President Obama. So we're discussing what needs to be done to make these substations more secure, why it is that we heard virtually nothing about this attack, and we have had no information about whether or not there's a search on for who perpetrated this attack, what their ultimate goal was, and overall looking at how insecure the grid may be and what the consequences could be of other attacks. And so that's what's going on this hour, in case you're just tuning us in and wondering what is this conversation. John Wellinghoff is our guest this hour. He is now a partner with Stoll Reeves. At the time of this incident, as I said, he was the chair of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Here's our phone number. Join us if you would like, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go next to an email. You'll understand this language better than I will. So let me give this to you. Mike on email says there are five or so 345 kV substations in Wisconsin that could cripple the state and affect Illinois and Minnesota. A large 500 or 750 MVA transformer is very large and difficult to protect. During World War II, many utilities built concrete firewalls around key transformers. Protection of these are not the only items that could cause a problem, although the loss of a large transformer would take years to replace. Loss of transmission, 345 or 765 kV lines that cross the country can do the same. You mentioned the 2004 outage. What do you see as the solution to this? Gardening facilities simply may not be enough.
Well, again, and the caller or the emailer is correct, you know, that these large facilities are hard to protect and that they are critical and can take years to replace if they permanently damage these transformers. But, you know, I think we have to do sort of a defense in depth look at this. I mean, you have to, first of all, ensure that local law enforcement understands how important these facilities are. So if there's, you know, calls with respect to suspicious activity, that they're immediately responded to. And then we do have to start putting in certain mitigation measures, including, as I mentioned, the opaque fencing and even barriers in front of these. The emailer mentioned the concrete barriers. There's things called Jersey walls that are, in essence, a concrete barrier that is a movable one that has been used successfully overseas and potentially is something that we might consider using in front of these very critical pieces of equipment.
What about the law enforcement ability to counter this kind of terrorism? Somebody said this wasn't an incident where Billy Bob and Joe decided after a few brewskis to come in and shoot up a substation. These people really knew what they were doing. They had AK-47s. What kind of response do we have in place to these kinds of sophisticated terrorists?
Well, I mean, that's up to, you know, Homeland Security, the FBI, and the local law enforcement individuals. You know, it's not an area that I have a lot of expertise in, and certainly an area that, you know, those individuals need to ensure that they're prepared. It's my understanding that Homeland Security is going to have a series of meetings around the country to meet with local law enforcement individuals to provide them with briefings and an update on this incident, and also to make them understand what facilities they have in their local area that are critical on these issues and that are similar to the ones in San Jose. And so I know that Homeland Security is proceeding on that as well, and I'm sure that there's other law enforcement agencies that are also working in this area.
Hmm. Well, they're kind of slow, aren't they? That was last April. It's almost a year ago.
Well, everyone would hope all this would happen instantly, but, you know, things unfortunately don't. I can't speak for Homeland as to their timing and staging of this.
Was Homeland called in right after this incident took place, Mr. Wellinghoff?
Well, we briefed Homeland very quickly after this incident, yes. I can't tell you how quickly, but within a month or two at the very outside, I'm sure that Homeland had a briefing, DOE had a briefing. I ultimately briefed the White House a couple months after this. The National Security Group in the White House was briefed as well. And at that briefing, Homeland and DOE and the FBI also attended as well. So there were multiple briefings that took place over a period of a couple months immediately following this incident.
Do you feel like everybody's on the same page?
I think so. I think everybody understands that this is an extremely serious event, and that it's something that we need to put a plan in place to protect against, and I think everybody's trying to do everything they can to do that.
Greg in Lombard, Illinois. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Great
Hi,
show as usual. Thank you.
Thank you.
A couple of observations and maybe a comment, if I may. Our infrastructure is so badly outdated. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it was in the Northeast. We had a squirrel that knocked out millions of people. This was not an eco terrorist. It was a squirrel. As your previous caller had mentioned, the solution is not transmitting power from Mississippi to New York City. It's regionalize it and minimize it. That's my observation. The other comment I would say, isn't this a great reason for people to put solar panels on their house, have a wind turbine, and get off the grid? I mean, really.
Okay, Greg, I think there's a little squirrel in your telephone line, but so I hate to let you go, but we got what you're saying, Greg. I mean, John.
Yeah, no, I think I don't disagree with Greg at all. Ultimately, I think it was a tree touch, whether the squirrel was involved with the tree or not, or the wind or whatever.
Mm.
But it was a tree touching a line that caused the 2003 blackout that blacked out all of the Northeast. I think that's been well documented. So it was a very minor incident, and it does show some level of lack of resiliency of the grid. And certainly we can look at the Hurricane Sandy, Hurricane Katrina, and other climactic events that show other reliability issues, as well as the ice storms that we periodically have throughout the Midwest and East as well. Yes, he's correct that I think we do need to move to a much more distributed system. I think, you know, solar energy presents great promise. We still need to have some storage associated with that to help it improve reliability on a distributed level, but I think we're going to get there. But ultimately, to make it a common and economical thing for people, it is going to take, you know, 5 to 10 years or more to be there. And again, in the interim, we have to, as I say, you know, deal with what we've got. We've got to live with what we've got. And what we've got right now is a system that is divided into three interconnects that could be vulnerable to these kinds of attacks. And we should do what we can to prioritize those nodes and protect them.
Thanks, Greg, so much for your call. John in Madison, hi.
Hi, I appreciate the show a great deal, and I'm with those who are calling for distributed energy. I have a question for the guest about undergrounding. We have huge transmission lines that are vulnerable, especially in states where there's drought conditions to fire and other natural disturbances in addition to the terrorist attacks and those substations as well. There's recent news that you can submerge computers in mineral oil and get 50% energy savings. I mean, doesn't it help to look at this as a climate resiliency issue as well as a terrorism threat suppression opportunity?
Well, potentially it does. But, again, those solutions of undergrounding either lines and or the substations themselves are extremely expensive. And there are probably other mitigation and protection measures that are less costly. I know, for example, the Chinese have undergrounded a number of their substations because I visited one in Shanghai, a very large 500 kVA substation in the middle of Shanghai that's down three stories in the middle of town. And I think, you know, they do it there in part because of the population densities and those issues. But, again, extremely expensive solutions to ultimately implement. And I think the less expensive solution are the immediate protection and then, as many callers have and commenters have indicated, then ultimately moving, migrating to a more distributed system that can be isolated and islanded from the rest of the system if something happens. I think that's the ultimate solution.
Thank you, John. Let's go to another John, Hurley in Hurley. Hi.
Hi, I hate to be a know-it-all, but I was in charge of a transmitter site in the UP in the 1980s, a TV transmitter. Boy, we had protection on everything that was expensive, like those Kleiss tubes. If that coolant level went down, the whole transmitter shut down. Before we spend, you know, another $20 billion, we're already spending $500 billion per year on homeland security. Let's spend about $1 billion and put some float switches in the transformers. I think that'd be a pretty cheap solution.
I'm sorry. What
Another
would
thing on this
John
is,
before you, what would that do?
Are you very
John?
Are
what's
you
a
very sure?
John? What's are a float switcher? What's a float switcher, John?
Are you asking me or your caller?
Oh, I'm sorry, John from Hurley. You want to explain that?
Yeah.
John? John's gone.
He's gone. I'm assuming that the caller was talking about perhaps the switch, if the oil goes down the transformer, it'll go off, or a temperature switch. They
okay.
already have those kind of switches. Most of them do. It doesn't do you a lot of good if there's a bullet inside that oil, because then you've got to scrap the whole transformer. So that kind of switch doesn't solve the problem of destroying the transformer.
Mm, okay. Wasn't there a lot of oil that spilled in this incident as well?
There's about 50,000 gallons because they hit the cooling fins where the oil is pumped through to cool the oil that's in the internal of the case, and all that oil spewed out cooling fins because they're under pressure.
Oh. Mr. Wellinghoff, please keep us informed as to what's happening with this story.
I will definitely do that, and thank you so much for having me on.
Our pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us. John Wellinghoff is immediate past chair of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. If you'd like to read this story in its entirety, it appeared February 4 in the Wall Street Journal, and we will post it on our Facebook page. Thanks very much to K.P. Whaley for producing this interesting hour, and thanks to K.P. Whaley as well for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We have news coming up momentarily, and we'll return with a fascinating hour about extreme medicine, I guess is the way to describe it, because that's the name of the book we'll be talking about in just a few minutes.